I could go ashore with you, she said. I would, if it please you.
You could go ashore, Theon agreed, squeezing her breast, but not with me, I fear.
I'd work in your castle, my lord. I can clean fish and bake bread and churn butter. Father says my pepper crab stew is the best he's ever tasted. You could find me a place in your kitchens, and I could make you pepper crab stew.
And warm my bed by night. He reached for the laces of her bodice and began to undo them, his fingers deft and practised.
Once I might have carried you home as a prize, and kept you to wife, whether you willed it or no. The armed men of old did such things. A man and his rock wife, his true bride, iron-born, like himself, but he had his salt wives, too, women captured on raids.
The girl's eyes grew wide, and not because he had bared her breasts.
I would be your salt wife, my lord.
I fear those days are gone. Theon's finger circled one heavy teat, spiralling in toward the fat brown nipple. No longer may we ride the wind with fire and sword, taking what we want. Now we scratch in the ground and toss lines in the sea like other men, and count ourselves lucky if we have salt cud and porridge enough to get us through a winter. He took her nipple in his mouth and bit it until she gasped.
You can put it in me again if it please you, she whispered in his ear as he sucked.
When he raised his head from her breast, the skin was dark red where his mouth had marked her.
It will please me to teach you something new. Unlace me, and pleasure me with your mouth. With my mouth?
His thumb brushed lightly over her full lips.
It's what those lips were made for, sweetling. If you were my salt wife, you'd do as I command.
She was timid at first, but learned quickly for such a stupid girl, which pleased him. Her mouth was as wet and sweet as her cunt, and this way he did not have to listen to her mindless prattle. Once I would have kept her as a salt wife in truth, he thought to himself, as he slid his fingers through her tangled hair. Once, when we still kept the old way, lived by the axe instead of the pick, taking what we would, be it wealth, women, or glory. In those days, the ironborn did not work mines. That was labour for the captives brought back from the hustings, and so too the sorry business of farming and tending goats and sheep. War was an iron man's proper trade. The Drowned God had made them to reeve and rape, to carve out kingdoms and write their names in fire and blood and song. Aegon the Dragon had destroyed the old way when he burned Black Heron, gave Heron's kingdom back to the weakling rivermen, and reduced the Iron Islands to an insignificant backwater of a much greater realm. Yet the old red tales were still told around driftwood fires and smoky hearths all across the islands, even behind the high stone halls of Pike. Theon's father numbered among his titles the style of Lord Reaper, and the Greyjoy words boasted that we do not so. It had been to bring back the old way more than for the empty vanity of a crown that Lord Balon had staged his great rebellion. Robert Baratheon had written a bloody end to that hope with the help of his friend Eddard Stark, but both men were dead now. Mere boys ruled in their stead, and the realm that Aegon the Conqueror had forged was smashed and sundered.
This is the season, Theon thought, as the captain's daughter slid her lips up and down the length of him. The season, the year, the day, and I am the man.
He smiled crookedly, wondering what his father would say when Theon told him that he, the last-born babe and hostage, he had succeeded where Lord Balon himself had failed. His climax came on him sudden as a storm, and he filled the girl's mouth with his seed. Startled, she tried to pull away, but Theon held her tight by the hair. Afterwards she crawled up beside him.
Did I please, my lord?
Well enough, he told her.
It tasted salty, she murmured.
Like the sea, she nodded.
I've always loved the sea, my lord.
As I have, he said, rolling her nipple idly between his fingers. It was true. The sea meant freedom to the men of the Iron Islands. He had forgotten that until the Mirraham had raised sail at Seaguard. The sounds brought old feelings back, the creak of wood and rope, the captain's shouted commands, the snap of the sails as the wind filled them, each as familiar as the beating of his own heart, and as comforting. I must remember this, Theon vowed to himself. I must never go far from the sea again.
Take me with you, my lord, the captain's daughter begged. I don't need to go to your castle. I can stay in some town and be your sort wife.
She reached out to stroke his cheek. Theon Greyjoy pushed a hand aside and climbed off the bunk. My place is Pike, and yours is on this ship.
I can't stay here now.
He laced up his breeches.
Why not? My father, she told him, once you're gone, he'll punish me, my lord. He'll call me names and hit me.
Theon swept his cloak off his peg and over his shoulders.
Fathers are like that, he admitted as he pinned the folds with a silver clasp. Tell him he should be pleased. As many times as I've fought you, you're likely with child. It's not every man who has the honour of raising a king's bastard.
She looked at him stupidly, so he left her there. The Mirraham was rounding a wooded point. Below the pine-clad bluffs, a dozen fishing boats were pulling in their nets. The big cog stayed well out from them, tacking. Theon moved to the bow for a better view. He saw the castle first, the stronghold of the Butleys. When he was a boy, it had been timber and wattle, but Robert Baratheon had razed the structure to the ground. Lord Sir Wayne had rebuilt in stone. For now, a small square keep crowned the hill. Pale green flags drooped from the squat corner towers, each emblazoned with a shoal of silvery fish. Beneath the dubious protection of the fish-ridden little castle lay the village of Lordsport, its harbour aswarm with ships. When last he'd seen Lordsport, it had been a smoking wasteland. The skeletons of burned longships and smashed galleys littering the stony shore like the bones of dead leviathans, the houses no more than broken walls and cold ashes. After 10 years, few traces of the war remained. The small folk had built new hovels with the stones of the old and cut fresh sod for their roofs. A new inn had risen beside the landing, twice the size of the old one, with a lower story of cut stone and 2 upper stories of timber. The sept beyond had never been rebuilt, though. Only a 7-sided foundation remained where it had stood. Robert Baratheon's fury had soured the Iron Men's taste for the new gods, it would seem. Theon was more interested in ships than gods. Among the masts of countless fishing boats, he spied a Tyroshi trading galley offloading beside a lumbering Ebonese cug with her black-tarred hull. A great number of long ships, 50 or 60 at the least, stood out to sea or lay beached on the pebble shore to the north. Some of the sails bore devices from the other islands. The Blood Moon of Winch, Lord Goodbrother's banded black warhorn, Hall Lord's silver scythe. Theon searched for his Uncle Urien's Silence. Of that lean and terrible red ship he saw no sign. But his father's great Kraken was there, her bow ornamented with a grey iron ram in the shape of its namesake. Had Lord Balin anticipated him and called the Greyjoy banners? His hand went inside his cloak again to the oilskin pouch. No one knew of his letter but Robb Stark. They were no fools to entrust their secret to a bird. Still, Lord Balin was no fool either. He might well have guessed why his son was coming home at long last, and acted accordingly. The thought did not please him. His father's war was long done and lost. This was Theon's hour, his plan, his glory, and in time his crown. Yet, if the Longships are hosting, it might be only a caution, now that he thought on it, a defensive move, lest the war spill out across the sea. Old men were cautious by nature. His father was old now, and so too his uncle, Victarion, who commanded the Iron Fleet. His uncle Euron was a different song, to be sure, but the silence did not seem to be in port. "It's all for the good," Theon told himself. "This way I shall be able to strike all the more quickly." As the Miriam made her way landward, Theon paced the deck restlessly, scanning the shore. He had not thought to find Lord Balin himself at Quayside, but surely his father would have sent someone to meet him. Silas Sourmouth, the steward, Lord Butley, perhaps even Dagmar Cleftjaw. It would be good to look on Dagmar's hideous old face again. It was not as though they had no word of his arrival. Rob had sent ravens from River Run, and when they'd found no longship at Seaguard, Jason Mallister had sent his own birds to Pike, supposing that Rob's were lost. Yet he saw no familiar faces, no honour guard waiting to escort him from Lordsport to Pike, only small folk going about their small business. Shore hands rolled casks of wine off the Tyrushy trader, fisher folk cried the day's catch, children ran and played. A priest, in the seawater robes of the drowned god, was leading a pair of horses along the pebble shore, while above him a slattern leaned out a window in the inn, calling out to some passing ebony sailors. A handful of Lordsport merchants had gathered to meet the ship. They shouted questions as the Miriam was tying up.
"We're out of Old Town," the captain called down. "Bearing apples and oranges, wines from the arbour, feathers from the summer isles. I have pepper, woven leathers, a boat of Moorish lace, mirrors for my lady, a pair of Old Town wood harps, sweet as any you've ever heard."
The gangplank descended with a creak and a thud.
"And I brought your heir back to you."
The Lordsport men gazed on Theon with blank, bovine eyes, and he realized they did not know who he was. It made him angry. He pressed a golden dragon into the captain's palm. "Have your men bring my things." Without waiting for a reply, he strode down the gangplank.
"Innkeeper," he barked, "I require a horse."
"As you say, my lord,"
the man responded without so much as a bow. He had forgotten how bold the ironborn could be.
"Happens as I have one might do. Where will you be riding, my lord?" "Pike!"
The fool still did not know him. He should have worn his good doublet, with a kraken embroidered on the breast. "You want to be off soon to reach Pike afore dark," the innkeeper said. "My boy will go with you and show you the way."
"Your boy will not be needed,"
a deep voice called,
"nor your horse. I shall see my nephew back to his father's house."
The speaker was the priest he had seen leading the horses along the shoreline. As a man approached, the small folk bent the knee, and Theon heard the innkeeper murmur, "Dampier." Tall and thin, with fierce black eyes and a beak of a nose, the priest was garbed in mottled robes of green and grey and blue, the swirling colours of the drowned god. A waterskin hung under his arm on a leather strap, and ropes of dried seaweed were braided through his waist-long black hair and untrimmed beard. A memory prodded at Theon. In one of his rare, curt letters, Lord Balin had written of his youngest brother going down in a storm and turning holy when he washed up safe on shore.
Uncle Aaron, he said doubtfully.
Nephew Theon,
the priest replied.
Your lord father bid me fetch you. Come.
In a moment, uncle. He turned back to the Mirham. My things, he commanded the captain. A sailor fetched him down his tall yew-bow and quiver of arrows, but it was the captain's daughter who brought the pack with his good clothing. My lord, her eyes were red. When he took the pack, she made as if to embrace him, there in front of her own father and his priestly uncle and half the island. Theon turned deftly aside. You have my thanks.
Please, she said. I do love you well, my lord.
I must go. He hurried off to his uncle, who was already well down the pier. Theon caught him with a dozen long strides.
I had not looked for you, uncle. After 10 years, I thought perhaps my lord father and lady mother might come themselves, or send Dagmar with an honour guard.
It is not for you to question the commands of the Lord Reaper of Pike.
The priest's manner was chilly, most unlike the man Theon remembered. Aaron Greyjoy had been the most amiable of his uncles, feckless and quick to laugh, fond of songs, ale, and women.
As to Dagmar, the cleft jaw is gone to Old Wick at your father's behest, to roust the stone houses and the drums.
To what purpose? Why are the longships hosting?
Why have longships ever hosted?
His uncle had left the horses tied up in front of the waterside inn. When they reached them, he turned to Theon.
Tell me true, nephew. Do you pray to the wolf gods now?
Theon seldom prayed at all, but it was not something you confessed to a priest, even your father's own brother.
Ned Stark prayed to a tree. No, I care nothing for Stark's gods.
Good. Kneel.
The ground was all stones and mud.
Uncle, I kneel, or are you too proud now? A lordling of the Green Lands come amongst us.
Theon knelt. He had a purpose here, and might need Aaron's help to achieve it. A crown was worth a little mud and horse shit on his breeches, he supposed.
Bow your head.
Lifting the skin, his uncle pulled the cork and directed a thin stream of seawater down upon Theon's head. It drenched his hair and ran over his forehead into his eyes. Sheets washed down his cheeks, and a finger crept under his cloak and doublet and down his back, a cold rivulet along his spine. The salt made his eyes burn, until it was all he could do not to cry out. He could taste the ocean on his lips.
Let Theon, your servant, be born again from the sea as you were,
Aaron Greyjoy intoned.
Bless him with salt, bless him with stone, bless him with steel. Nephew, do you still know the words?
What is dead may never die, Theon said, remembering.
What is dead may never die, his uncle echoed, but rises again harder and stronger. Stand.
Theon stood, blinking back tears from the salt in his eyes. Wordless, his uncle corked the water skin, untied his horse, and mounted. Theon did the same. They set off together, leaving the inn and the harbour behind them, up past the castle of Lord Butley into the stony hills. The priest ventured no further word.
I've been half my life away from home, Theon ventured at last. Will I find the islands changed?
Men fish the sea, dig in the earth, and die. Women birth children in blood and pain, and die. Night follows day. The winds and tides remain. The islands are as our God made them.
God, she has grown grim, Theon thought.
Will I find my sister and my lady mother at Pike?
You will not. Your mother dwells at Harlaw with her own sister. It is less raw there, and her cough troubles her. Your sister has taken Black Wind to Great Wick with messages from your lord father. She will return here long, you may be sure.
Theon did not need to be told that Black Wind was Usher's longship. He had not seen his sister in 10 years, but that much he knew of her. Odd that she would call it that, when Robb Stark had a wolf named Grey Wind. "Stark is grey, and Greyjoy's black," he murmured, smiling. "But it seems we're both windy." The priest had nothing to say to that. "And what of you, Uncle?" Theon asked. "You were no priest when I was taken from Pyke. I remember how you would sing the old reaving songs, standing on the table with a horn of ale in hand." "Young I was, and vain," Aaron Greyjoy said. "But the sea washed my follies and my vanities away. That man drowned, nephew. His lungs filled with seawater, and the fish ate the scales off his eyes. When I rose again, I saw clearly."
"He is as mad as he is sour."
Theon had liked what he remembered of the old Aaron Greyjoy.
"Uncle, why has my father called his swords and sails?"
"Doubtless he would tell you at Pyke."
"I would know his plans now."
"From me you shall not. We are commanded not to speak of this to any man."
"Even to me?"
Theon's anger flared. He'd led men in war, hunted with a king, won honour in tawny melees, ridden with Brynden Blackfish and Greyjon Umber, fought in the Whispering Wood, bedded more girls than he could name, and yet this uncle was treating him as though he were still a child of 10.
"If my father makes plans for war, I must know of them. I'm not any man. I'm heir to Pyke and the Iron Islands."
"As to that," his uncle said, "we shall see."
The words were a slap in the face.
"We shall see? My brothers are both dead. I am my lord father's only living son."
"Your sister lives."
"Asha," he thought, confounded. She was 3 years older than Theon, yet still.
"A woman may inherit only if there's no male heir in the direct line," he insisted loudly. "I will not be cheated of my rights, I warn you."
His uncle grunted.
"You warn a servant of the drowned god, boy? You have forgotten more than you know. And you are a great fool if you believe your lord father will ever hand these holy islands over to a Stark. Now be silent. The ride is long enough without your magpie chatterings."
Theon held his tongue, though not without a struggle. "So that is the way of it," he thought. As if 10 years in Winterfell could make a Stark. Lord Eddard had raised him among his own children, but Theon had never been one of them. The whole castle, from Lady Stark to the lowliest kitchen scullion, knew he was hostage to his father's good behaviour, and treated him accordingly. Even the bastard Jon Snow had been accorded more honour than he had. Lord Eddard had tried to play the father from time to time, but to Theon he had always remained the man who'd brought blood and fire to Pyke, and taken him from his home. As a boy, he had lived in fear of Stark's stern face and great dark sword. His wife was, if anything, even more distant and suspicious. As for their children, the younger ones had been mewling babes for most of his years at Winterfell. Only Robb and his base-born half-brother Jon Snow had been old enough to be worth his notice. The bastard was a sullen boy, quick to sense a slight, jealous of Theon's high birth and Robb's regard for him. For Robb himself, Theon did have a certain affection as for a younger brother, but it would be best not to mention that. In Pyke, it would seem, the old wars were still being fought. That ought not surprise him. The Iron Islands lived in the past. The present was too hard and bitter to be borne. Besides, his father and uncles were old, and the old lords were like that. They took their dusty feuds to the grave, forgetting nothing and forgiving less. It had been the same with the Malisters, his companions on the ride from Riveron to Seaguard. Patrick Mallister was not too ill a fellow. They shared a taste for wenches, wine, and hawking. But when old Lord Jason saw his heir growing overly fond of Theon's company, he had taken Patrick aside to remind him that Seaguard had been built to defend the coast against reavers from the Iron Islands, the Greyjoys of Pike chief among them. Their booming tower was named for its immense bronze bell, rung of old to call the townsfolk and farmhands into the castle when longships were sighted on the western horizon. "Never mind that the bell has been rung just once in 300 years, Patrick told Theon the day after, as he shared his father's cautions and a jug of green apple wine. "When my brother stormed Seaguard," Theon said. Lord Jason had slain Roderick Greyjoy under the walls of the castle and thrown the Iron Man back into the bay. "If your father supposes that I bear him some enmity for that, it's only because he never knew Roderick." They had a laugh over that as they raced ahead to an amorous young miller's wife that Patrick knew. Would that Patrick were with me now. Mallister or no, he was a more amiable riding companion than this sour old priest that his uncle Aaron had turned into. The path they rode wound up and up into bare and stony hills. Soon they were out of sight of the sea, though the smell of salt still hung sharp in the damp air. They kept a steady, plodding pace, past a shepherd's croft and the abandoned workings of a mine. This new holy Aaron Greyjoy was not much for talk. They rode in a gloom of silence. Finally, Theon could suffer it no longer. "Robb Stark is Lord of Winterfell now," he said. Aaron rode on. "One wolf is much like the other. Robb has broken fealty with the Iron Throne and crowned himself king in the north. There's war. The Maester's ravens fly over salt as soon as rock. This news is old and cold." "It means a new day, Uncle." "Every morning brings a new day, much like the old. In River Run, they would tell you different. They say the Red Comet is a herald of a new age, a messenger from the gods." "A sign it is," the priest agreed. "But from our god, not theirs. A burning brand it is, such as our people carried of old. It is the flame the drowned god brought from the sea, and it proclaims a rising tide. It is time to hoist our sails and go forth into the world with fire and sword as he did." Theon smiled. "I could not agree more. A man agrees with God as a raindrop with a storm." "This raindrop will one day be a king, old man." Theon had suffered quite enough of his uncle's gloom. He put his spurs into his horse and trotted on ahead, smiling. It was nigh on sunset when they reached the walls of Pike, a crescent of dark stone that ran from cliff to cliff, with a gatehouse in the centre and three square towers to either side. Theon could still make out the scars left by the stones of Robert Baratheon's catapults. A new south tower had risen from the ruins of the old, its stone a paler shade of grey, and as yet unmarred by patches of lichen. That was where Robert had made his breach, swarming in over the rubble and corpses with his war hammer in hand and Ned Stark at his side. Theon had watched from the safety of the sea tower, and sometimes he still saw the torches in his dreams and heard the dull thunder of the collapse. The gate stood open to him, the rusted iron portcullis drawn up. The guards atop the battlements watched with strangers' eyes as Theon Greyjoy came home at last. Beyond the curtain wall were 50 acres of headland, hard against the sky and the sea. The stables were here, and the kennels, and a scatter of other outbuildings. Sheep and swine huddled in their pens while the castle dogs ran free. To the south were the cliffs, and the wide stone bridge to the great keep. Theon could hear the crashing of waves as he swung down from his saddle. A stableman came to take his horse. A pair of gaunt children and some thralls stared at him with dull eyes, but there was no sign of his lord father, nor anyone else he recalled from boyhood. A bleak and bitter homecoming, he thought. The priest had not dismounted. "Will you not stay the night and share our meat and mead, uncle?" "Bring you, I was told. You are brought. Now I return to our God's business." Aaron Greyjoy turned his horse and rode slowly out beneath the muddy spikes of the portcullis. A bent-back old crone, in a shapeless grey dress, approached him warily.
"My lord, I am sent to show you two chambers, by whose bidding?" "Your lord father, my lord."
Theon pulled off his gloves.
"So, you do know who I am. Why is my father not here to greet me?" "He awaits you in the sea tower, my lord, when you are rested from your trip."
"And I thought Ned Stark cold.
And who are you?" "Hellier, who keeps his castle for your lord father."
"Silas was Stuart here. They called him Sourmouth." Even now, Theon could recall the whiny stench from the old man's breath.
"Dead these 5 years, my lord."
"And what of Maester Caelan? Where is he?"
"He sleeps in the sea. Windermere keeps the ravens now."
"It is as if I were a stranger here," Theon thought. "Nothing has changed, and yet everything has changed." "Show me to my chambers, woman," he commanded. Bowing stiffly, she led him across the headland to the bridge. That at least was as he remembered, the ancient stones slick with spray and spotted by lichen, the sea foaming under their feet like some great wild beast, the salt wind clutching at their clothes. Whenever he'd imagined his homecoming, he had always pictured himself returning to the snug bedchamber in the sea tower, where he'd slept as a child. Instead, the old woman led him to the bloody keep. The halls here were larger and better furnished, if no less cold nor damp. Theon was given a suite of chilly rooms with ceilings so high that they were lost in gloom. He might have been more impressed if he had not known that these were the very chambers that had given the bloody keep its name. 1,000 years before, the sons of the River King had been slaughtered here, hacked to bits in their beds, so that pieces of their bodies might be sent back to their father on the mainland. But Greyjoys were not murdered in Pike, except once in a great while, by their brothers, and his brothers were both dead. It was not fear of ghosts that made him glance about with distaste. The wall hangings were green with mildew, the mattress musty-smelling and sagging, the rushes old and brittle. Years had come and gone since these chambers had last been opened. The damp went bone-deep. "I'll have a basin of hot water and a fire in this hearth," he told the crone. "See that they light braziers in the other rooms to drive out some of the chill. And gods be good, get someone in here at once to change these rushes."
"Yes, my lord, as you command."
She fled. After some time, they brought the hot water he had asked for. It was only tepid and soon cold, and seawater in the bargain. But it served to wash the dust of the long ride from his face and hair and hands. While two thralls lit his braziers, Theon stripped off his travel-stained clothing and dressed to meet his father. He chose boots of supple black leather, soft lamb's wool breeches of silvery grey, a black velvet doublet with the golden kraken of the Greyjoys embroidered on the breast. Around his throat he fastened a slender gold chain, around his waist a belt of bleached white leather. He hung a dirk at one hip and a longsword at the other, in scabbards striped black and gold. Drawing the dirk, he tested its edge with his thumb, pulled a whetstone from his belt pouch, and gave it a few licks. He prided himself on keeping his weapon sharp. "When I return, I shall expect a warm room and clean rushes," he warned the thralls, as he drew on a pair of black gloves, the silk decorated with a delicate scrollwork tracery in golden thread. Theon returned to the great keep through a covered stone walkway, the echoes of his footsteps mingling with the ceaseless rumble of the sea below. To get to the sea tower on its crooked pillar, he had to cross three further bridges, each narrower than the one before. The last was made of rope and wood, and the wet salt wind made it sway underfoot like a living thing. Theon's heart was in his mouth by the time he was halfway across. A long way below, the waves threw up tall plumes of spray as they crashed against the rock. As a boy, he used to run across this bridge, even in the black of night. "Boys believe nothing can hurt them," his dart whispered. "Grown men know better." The door was grey wood studded with iron, and Theon found it barred from the inside. He hammered on it with a fist, and cursed when a splinter snagged the fabric of his glove. The wood was damp and mouldy, the iron studs rusted. After a moment the door was opened from within by a guard in a black iron breastplate and pot helm. "You are the son? Out of my way, or you'll learn who I am." The man stood aside. Theon climbed the twisting steps to the solar. He found his father seated beside a brazier, beneath a robe of musty seal skins that covered him foot to chin. At the sound of boots on stone, the Lord of the Iron Islands lifted his eyes to behold his last living son. He was smaller than Theon remembered him, and so gaunt. Balon Greyjoy had always been thin, but now he looked as though the guards had put him in a cauldron and boiled every spare ounce of flesh from his bones until nothing remained but hair and skin. Bone thin and bone hard he was, with a face that might have been chipped from flint. His eyes were flinty too, black and sharp, but the years and the salt winds had turned his hair the grey of a winter sea, flecked with whitecaps. Unbound, it hung past the small of the beck.
9 years, is it?"
Lord Balon said at last. 10, Theon answered, pulling off his torn gloves.
"A boy they took,"
his father said.
"What are you now?"
"A man," Theon answered. "Your blood and your heir." Lord Balon grunted.
"Ha! We shall see."
"You shall," Theon said.
10 years, you say? Stark had you as long as I. And now you come as his envoy?"
"Not his," Theon said. "Lord Eddard is dead, beheaded by the Lannister Queen."
"They're both dead, Stark and that Robert, who broke my walls with his stones. I vowed I'd live to see them both in their graves, and I have." He grimaced. "Yet the cold and the damp still make my joints ache, as when they were alive. So what does it serve?"
"It serves," Theon moved closer. "I'll bring a letter."
"Did Ned Stark dress you like that?"
his father interrupted, squinting up from beneath his robe.
"Was it his pleasure to garb you in velvets and silks and make you his own sweet daughter?"
Theon felt the blood rising to his face.
"I'm no man's daughter. If you mislike my garb, I will change it."
"You will."
Throwing off the furs, Lord Balon pushed himself to his feet. He was not so tall as Theon remembered.
"That bauble around your neck, was it bought with gold or iron?"
Theon touched the gold chain. He had forgotten. It had been so long. In the old way, women might decorate themselves with ornaments bought with coin, but a warrior wore only the jewelry he took off the corpses of enemies slain by his own hand. Paying the iron price, it was called.
You blush red as a maid, Sion. A question was asked. Is it the gold price you paid, or the iron?
The gold, Sion admitted. His father slid his fingers under the necklace and gave it a yank so hard it was like to take Theon's head off, had the chain not snapped first.
"My daughter has taken an axe for a lover," Lord Balin said. "I will not have my son bedeck himself like a whore."
He dropped the broken chain onto the brazier, where it slid down among the coals.
"It is as I feared. The Greenlands have made you soft, and the Starks have made you theirs. You're wrong. Ned Stark was my jailer, but my blood is still salt and iron."
Lord Balin turned away to warm his bony hands over the brazier.
"Yet the Stark pup sends you to me like a well-trained raven, clutching his little message."
"There is nothing small about the letter I bear," Theon said, "and the offer he makes is one I suggested to him."
"This wolf-king heeds your counsel, does he?"
The notion seemed to amuse Lord Balin.
"He heeds me, yes. I've hunted with him, trained with him, shared meat and mead with him, warded his side. I've earned his trust. He looks on me as an older brother. He—"
"No."
His father jabbed a finger at his face.
"Not here. Not in Pike. Not in my hearing. You will not name him brother. This son of the man who put your true brothers to the sword. Or have you forgotten Roderick and Maron, who were your own blood?"
"I forget nothing."
Ned Stark had killed neither of his brothers in truth. Roderick had been slain by Lord Jason Mannister at Seaguard. Maron crushed in the collapse of the old South Tower. But Stark would have done for them just as quick, had the tide of battle chanced to sweep them together.
"I remember my brothers very well," Theon insisted. Chiefly he remembered Roderick's drunken cuffs and Maron's cruel japes and endless lies. "I remember when my father was a king too."
He took out Rob's letter and thrust it forward.
"Here, read it, Your Grace."
Lord Balin broke the seal and unfolded the parchment. His black eyes flicked back and forth.
"So, the boy would give me a crown again," he said, "and all I need to do is destroy his enemies."
His thin lips twisted in a smile.
"By now, Rob is at the Golden Tooth," Theon said. "Once it falls, he'll be through the hills in a day. Lord Tywin's host is at Harrenhal, cut off from the west. The Kingslayer is a captive at River Run. Only Sir Stafford Lannister and the raw green levies he's been gathering remain to oppose Rob in the west. Sir Stafford will put himself between Rob's army and Lannisport, which means the city will be undefended when we descend on it by sea. If the guards are with us, even Castle Rock itself may fall, before the Lannisters so much as realise that we are upon them."
Lord Balin grunted.
"Castle Rock has never fallen."
"Until now," Theon smiled, "and how sweet that will be."
His father did not return the smile.
"So this is why Rob Stark sends you back to me after so long. So you might win my consent to this plan of his."
"It is my plan, not Rob's," Theon said proudly.
"Mine, as a victory will be mine, and in time the crown. I will lead the attack myself, if it please you. As my reward, I would ask that you grant me Casterly Rock for my own seat, once we have taken it from the Lannisters."
With the rock, he could hold Lannisport and the Golden Lands to the west. It would mean wealth and power such as House Greyjoy had never known.
You reward yourself handsomely for a notion and a few lines of scribbling."
His father read the letter again.
"The pup says nothing about a reward, only that you speak for him, and I am to listen, and give him my sails and swords, and in return he will give me a crown."
His flinty eyes lifted to meet his son's.
"He will give me a crown," he repeated, his voice growing sharp. "A poor choice of words. What is meant is, what is meant is what is said. The boy will give me a crown, and what is given can be taken away."
Lord Balin tossed the letter under the brazier atop the necklace. The parchment curled, blackened, and took flame. Theon was aghast.
"Have you gone mad?"
His father laid a stinging backhand across his cheek.
"Mind your tongue. You're not in Winterfell now, and I am not Rob the Boy, that you should speak to me so. I am the Greyjoy, Lord Reaper of Pike, King of Salt and Rock, son of the Sea Wind, and no man gives me a crown. I pay the iron price. I will take my crown, as Euron Redhead did 5,000 years ago."
Theon edged backward, away from the sudden fury in his father's tone.
"Take it, then," he spat, his cheeks still tingling. "Call yourself King of the Iron Islands. No one will care until the wars are over, and the victor looks about and spies the old fool perched off his shore with an iron crown on his head."
Lord Balin laughed.
"Well, at least you're no craven. No more than I'm a fool. Do you think I gather my ships to watch them rock at anchor, eh? I mean to carve out a kingdom with fire and sword, but not from the west, and not at the bidding of King Rob the Boy. Casterly Rock is too strong, and Lord Tywin too cunning by half. Aye, we might take Lannisport, but we should never keep it. No, I hunger for a different plum. Not so juicy sweet, to be sure, yet it hangs there, ripe and undefended."
"Where?" Theon might have asked, but by then he knew.
Circe. "Oh, I pray the Seven will not let it rain upon the king's wedding," Jocelyn Swift said as she laced up the queen's gown. "No one wants rain," said Circe. For herself she wanted sleet and ice, howling winds, thunder to shake the very stones of the Red Keep. She wanted a storm to match her rage. To Jocelyn she said, "Tighter, cinch it tighter, you simpering little fool!" It was the wedding that enraged her, though the slow-witted Swift girl made a safer target. Tommen's hold upon the Iron Throne was not secure enough for her to risk offending Highgarden, not so long as Stannis Baratheon held Dragonstone and Storm's End, so long as Riverrun continued in defiance, so long as Iron Men prowled the seas like wolves. So Jocelyn must needs eat the meal Circe would sooner have served to Marjorie Tyrell and her hideous wrinkled grandmother. To break her fast, the queen sent to the kitchens for 2 boiled eggs, a loaf of bread, and a pot of honey. But when she cracked the first egg and found a bloody half-formed chick inside, her stomach roiled. "Take this away and bring me hot spiced wine," she told Sennel. The chill in the air was settling in her bones, and she had a long, nasty day ahead of her. Nor did Jamie help her mood when he turned up, all in white and still unshaven, to tell her how he meant to keep her son from being poisoned. "I will have men in the kitchens, watching as each dish is prepared," he said. "Sir Adam's gold cloaks will escort the servants as they bring the food to table to make certain no tampering takes place along the way. Sir Boros will be tasting every course before Tommen puts a bite into his mouth, And if all that should fail, Maester Balabar will be seated in the back of the hall, with purges and antidotes for 20 common poisons on his person. Tommen will be safe, I promise you. Safe. The word tasted bitter on her tongue. Jamie did not understand. No one understood. Only Malara had been in the tent to hear the old hags croaking threats, and Malara was long dead. Tyrion will not kill the same way twice. He is too cunning for that. He could be under the floor even now, listening to every word we say and making plans to open Tommen's throat. Suppose he was, said Jamie. Whatever plans he makes, he will still be small and stunted. Tommen will be surrounded by the finest knights in Westeros. The King's Guard will protect him. Circe glanced at where the sleeve of her brother's white silk tunic had been pinned up over his stump. I remember how well they guarded Joffrey, these splendid knights of yours. I want you to remain with Tommen all night. Is that understood? I will have a guardsman outside his door. She seized his arm. Not a guardsman. You, and inside his bedchamber. In case Tyrion crawls out of the hearth, he won't. So you say. Will you tell me that you found all the hidden tunnels in these walls? They both knew better. I will not have Tommen alone with Margaery, not for so much as half a heartbeat. They will not be alone. Her cousins will be with them. As will you. I command it in the king's name. Circe had not wanted Tommen and his wife to share a bed at all, but the Tyrells had insisted. Husband and wife should sleep together, the Queen of Thorns had said, even if they do no more than sleep. His Grace's bed is big enough for two, surely. Lady Allery had echoed her good mother. Let the children warm each other in the night. It will bring them closer. Margaery oft shares her blankets with her cousins. They sing and play games and whisper secrets to each other when the candles are snuffed out. How delightful, Circe had said. Let them continue by all means, in the maiden vault. I am sure Her Grace knows best, Lady Olenna had said to Lady Allery. She is the boy's own mother, after all. Of that we are all sure, and surely we can agree about the wedding night. A man should not sleep apart from his wife on the night of their wedding. It is ill luck for their marriage if they do. Some day I will teach you the meaning of ill luck, the queen had vowed. Margaery may share Tommen's bedchamber for that one night, she had been forced to say. No longer. Your Grace is so gracious, the Queen of Thorns had replied, and everyone had exchanged smiles. Cersei's fingers were digging into Jamie's arm hard enough to leave bruises. I need eyes inside that room, she said. To see what? He said. There can be no danger of a consummation. Tommen is much too young. And Ossifer Plum was much too dead. But that did not stop him fathering a child, did it? Her brother looked lost. Who was Ossifer Plum? Was he Lord Philip's father, or who? He is near as ignorant as Robert. All his wits were in his sword hand. Forget Plum. Just remember what I told you. Swear to me that you will stay by Tommen's side until the sun comes up. As you command, he said, as if her fears were groundless. Do you still mean to go ahead and burn the Tower of the Hand? After the feast. It was the only part of the day's festivities that Circe thought she might enjoy. Our Lord Father was murdered in that tower. I cannot bear to look at it. If the gods are good, the fire may smoke a few rats from the rubble. Jamie rolled his eyes. Tyrion, you mean? Him and Lord Varys and this jailer? If any of them were hiding in the tower, we would have found them. I've had a small army going at it with picks and hammers. We've knocked through walls and ripped up floors and uncovered 50 secret passages. And for all you know, there may be 50 more. Some of the secret crawlways had turned out to be so small that Jamie had needed pages and stable boys to explore them. A passage to the black cells had been found, and a stone well that seemed to have no bottom. They had found a chamber full of skulls and yellowed bones, and 4 sacks of tarnished silver coins from the reign of the first King Viserys. They had found 1,000 rats as well, but neither Tyrion nor Varys had been amongst them, and Jaime had finally insisted on putting an end to the search. One boy had gotten stuck in a narrow passage and had to be pulled out by his feet, shrieking. Another fell down a shaft and broke his legs. And 2 guardsmen vanished, exploring a side tunnel. Some of the other guards swore they could hear them calling faintly through the stone, but when Jaime's men tore down the wall, they found only earth and rubble on the far side. "The imp is small and cunning. He may still be in the walls. If he is, the fire will smoke him out. Even if Tyrion were still hiding in the castle, he won't be in the Tower of the Hand. We've reduced it to a shell. Would that we could do the same to the rest of this foul castle," said Circe. "After the war, I mean to build a new palace beyond the river." She had dreamed of it the night before last, a magnificent white castle surrounded by woods and gardens, long leagues from the stinks and noise of King's Landing. "This city is a cesspit. For half a groat, I would move the court to Lannisport and rule the realm from Casterly Rock. That would be an even greater folly than burning the Tower of the Hand. So long as Tommen sits the Iron Throne, the realm sees him as the true king. Hide him under the rock, and he becomes just another claimant to the throne, no different than Stannis." "I am aware of that," the queen said sharply. "I said that I wanted to move the court to Lannisport, not that I would. Were you always this slow, or did losing a hand make you stupid?" Jaime ignored that. "If these flames spread beyond the tower, you may end up burning down the castle, whether you mean to or not. Wildfire is treacherous. Lord Halline has assured me that his pyromancers can control the fire. The Guild of Alchemists had been brewing fresh wildfire for a fortnight. Let all of King's Landing see the flames. It will be a lesson to our enemies." "Now you sound like Ares." Her nostrils flared. "Guard your tongue, sir." "I love you too, sweet sister." How could I ever have loved that wretched creature? She wondered after he had gone. "He was your twin, your shadow, your other half," another voice whispered. "Once, perhaps," she thought. "No longer. He has become a stranger to me." Compared to the magnificence of Joffrey's nuptials, the wedding of King Tommen was a modest affair and small. No one wanted another lavish ceremony, least of all the queen, and no one wanted to pay for one, least of all the Tyrells. So the young king took Marjorie Tyrell to wife in the Red Keep's royal sept, with fewer than 100 guests looking on in place of the thousands who had seen his brother joined to the same woman. The bride was fair and gay and beautiful, the groom still baby-faced and plump. He recited his vows in a high, childish voice, promising his love and devotion to Mace Tyrell's twice-widowed daughter. Marjorie wore the same gown she had worn to marry Joffrey, an airy confection of sheer ivory silk, mirish lace, and seed pearls. Circe herself was still in black, as a sign of mourning for her murdered firstborn. His widow might be pleased to laugh and drink and dance and put all memory of Joff aside, but his mother would not forget him so easily. "This is wrong," she thought. "It is too soon. A year, 2 years, that would have been time enough. Highgarden should have been content with a betrothal." Circe stared back to where Mace Tyrell stood between his wife and mother. "You forced me into this travesty of a wedding, my lord, and I shall not soon forget it." When it was time for the changing of the cloaks, the bride sank gracefully to her knees, and Tommen covered her with the heavy cloth of gold monstrosity that Robert had cloaked Circe in on their own wedding day, with the crowned stag of Baratheon worked upon its back in beads of onyx. Circe had wanted to use the fine red silk cloak Joffrey had used. "It was the cloak my lord father used when he wed my lady mother," she explained to the Tyrells, but the Queen of Thorns had balked her in that as well. "That old thing," the crone had said, "it looks a bit threadbare to me, and I dare say unlucky. And wouldn't a stag be more fitting for King Robert's true-born son? In my day a bride donned her husband's colours, not his lady mother's." Thanks to Stannis and his filthy letter, There were already too many rumours concerning Tommen's parentage. Cersei dared not fan the fires by insisting that he drape his bride in Lannister crimson, so she yielded as gracefully as she could.